Welcome to the Inside Data Center podcast. I am Andy Davis, and in this podcast, I will interview the people working in the data center sector and tell their stories. If you are working in the DC sector or you are looking to work in the sector, then this is the podcast for you. Welcome to the Inside Data Center podcast. Today, I'm joined by Matt Pullen, the EVP Managing Director for Europe of CyrusOne. Morning, Matt.
Morning, Andy.
How are you doing? You well?
I'm good. I'm good. Enjoying lockdown, of course, just like everybody else.
Yeah, a fellow UK lockdowner. Not long left, hopefully. We'll be out on the downwards track now, I guess.
Let's hope so.
It's great to have you on the podcast. Anyway, I'm really looking forward to learning a bit more about your career and also about CyrusOne and your activity at present in Europe. But do you just want to give everyone a quick introduction of kind of who you are and what you do in your current role at CyrusOne?
Sure, no problem. As you said, I'm the EVP and Managing Director for Europe at CyrusOne. Effectively, I'm overseeing the business end-to-end in Europe, and I'm part of the senior management team of the global company. So obviously interfacing on a daily basis with the US.
It keeps you busy, I'm sure, especially at the moment.
Especially at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. What I always like to do is just go back to the beginning of your career, just to give people an idea of how you first started in the industry, really. I know you spent quite a lot of time with CBRE, but what did you study at college or university, and how did you end up in the data center industry?
Yeah, it was quite an interesting journey. So as a kid, I never envisaged I'd be doing what I'm doing. I joined the Royal Air Force as a trainee pilot straight out of school, but that didn't go so well. So I felt I needed to find a vocational degree to then, you know, pursue another career. So I did a real estate degree at City University and joined Richard Ellis as a graduate surveyor in 1990. After a few years, I transitioned into what was a very new thing called corporate real estate services, which was the part of the business that provided services to occupiers. And in the early 90s, we had one client, which was AT&T, but that soon became three due to Trivestiture, Lucent, NCR, and AT&T. And in 95, I took on the role as being the account manager for AT&T in Europe. And AT&T, unlike a lot of other customers, was quite happy for the mainstream real estate elements of the portfolio to be managed together with the technical elements of the portfolio, be it their POPs or network operating centers, etc. And they were very good at training people. So they used to send me off to the AT&T Learning Center so that I could understand how the telephone worked, how a 5E switch worked, et cetera, which gave me a little bit of knowledge, which proved to be very, very dangerous in the end. So at the end of the 90s, when the big US telcos decided to start deploying their networks into Europe, we were introduced to quite a few of the new startups, companies like Global Crossing, by AT&T. And I built a little team within CBRE to manage a big acquisition program during the telco boom. And really, the rest is history in the sense we built up the team at CBRE to 15, 16 people during that time, undertook, you know, vast amount of transactional work across Europe. But then it all came to a bit of a crashing end, or so we thought, in 2001. But luckily, AT&T again came to the rescue and had a vision to hoover up a lot of the surplus colo space to deploy their high-speed data network POPs. And so the team reinvented themselves and acquired about 150 POPs in a couple of years across the world. 9/11 obviously had a big impact then on really driving the enterprise data center market. So once we'd done the AT&T work, we sort of repositioned ourselves to start working for the big investment banks in acquiring data centers. My career, unfortunately, fortunately, but
at the time, unfortunately.
Yeah. We went through quite a lot of M&A activity at Richard Ellis. So we were bought by Insignia, and then in 2002, CB bought Richard Ellis, all the components of Richard Ellis, to be the CBRE that you see today. And then we bought Trammell Crowe in 2006. So my corporate services job, and I was running the function at the time, just grew and grew and grew. And that's when Andrew Jay came in to run the data center team at CBRE. But I always kept a really close connection to the data center world, and would quite often be asked to give advice on usually M&A activity, the real estate aspects. So in 2012, for example, I advised Digital Realty on the acquisition of Centrum from a real estate perspective. And prior to that, I'd helped Commercial Union acquire a stake in Global Switch. And it just became pretty evident that I should be really looking to focus on data centers exclusively. And when Centrum was sold and Franek Sosnowicki came out of Centrum, he felt he had unfinished business, wanted to start a new company. So we started Xenium. And as you know, we sold that business in part in 2017, the Turkish operations, to Equinix. And in 2018, we sold the UK and German elements of the business to CyrusOne. And here I am.
Here you are. I was quite interested to know what it was like being part of Xenium at that point, because we're obviously seeing a lot of M&A activity at the moment, and there's a lot of businesses and people that are probably in that position where they're merging into a larger organization. How was it for you when you went from sort of being Xenium to being Xenium within CyrusOne?
It was fine, in the sense that I'd spent nearly all of my career working for a US public company, and a public company that had been through significant periods of M&A activity. So the change didn't bother me at all. I was really used to the US culture, and the US approach, where the majority of the business is centered in the US, and they're looking to grow, you know, other regional businesses. So the transition was okay.
So, yeah, because I think it's something that a lot of people, I guess, at all levels kind of worry about when their business gets acquired. Like, how do you become part of what is now a bigger organization? It can be quite a difficult transition, I think, for people to make.
I was nervous when I got my first pair of cowboy boots. But at least it made me a bit taller.
But yeah, that's very true. I could probably do some myself for that. And obviously, you've had a very successful career. So I just wanted to touch on kind of, is there anything, you know, you've learned along the way that you'd like to share? Are there any particular tips on how you think people can develop successfully within the industry?
I think just in terms of focus, what I found extremely important to always keep front of mind in real estate is location, location, location. And then also, as far as any asset class is concerned, research, market research, always knowing what is going on in the markets within which you're either providing services or you're operating. You know, you've got to know what your competition are doing. You've got to know what the latest trends are in terms of your customers and where they may be going. And that's why at CBRE, the data center team was always underpinned by, you know, extensive market research, which we started right at the beginning of the telco boom and never gave up on. Because I just don't think you can, you know, you can't provide good advice or make good decisions in the role that I'm in without that absolute clinical view around the right location, and without market data really helping you and preventing you from just making intuitive decisions.
Yeah. Do you think it's easier now to get that information? Because obviously there's a lot more research, there's a lot more access to it, the industry's a bit more exposed. So is it easier now, or do you think it's just different? You know, you've gone from probably finding a lot of the information out through conversations and networking to having access to a lot of that information online.
It's more difficult in the sense that, you know, the market is not simple anymore. It's not just colo providers. In major markets. The market is colo providers and, of course, the hyperscalers themselves and their self-build projects. You know, trying to get a holistic view of the data center market is challenging, but mainly because the hyperscalers are obviously very sensitive about information and want to maintain strict confidentiality because, you know, they're competing very hard with each other in this, you know, what is new market to ensure, you know, they win out from a market share point of view. So that's challenging. Also, I think the pace of the market creates some challenges in that, you know, no longer are sort of relatively small deals done in fully built facilities. What you're looking at largely is massive pre-lets, and the scale is just increasing each year. And, you know, fully understanding the timing of delivery relative to those pre-lets, and therefore a forecasted view on the scale of the market any point over the next few years is quite tricky.
Yeah, no, that is true. I think there is still obviously quite a large element of secrecy within the industry, which does make it difficult for all of us, I think, to find out what we want to know and to have access to that information. But it's definitely getting better, I think. Anyway, I wanted to obviously talk about CyrusOne. You know, that's kind of one of the reasons why we've got you on here, and particularly in Europe. Obviously, in Europe at the moment, we've seen significant demand increase, and we have globally really over the last 12 months. So I just wanted to touch on the regions where you're active in at present. Obviously in London, I know you're developing new facilities and you've got launching new facilities, and obviously you've got an existing footprint as well. What's it been like being involved during this period of growth in the London region? And do you have further plans to develop as well?
Yeah. So we just on Friday, we took possession of our fifth facility, London 5, funnily enough. Four of our facilities are basically, you know, in or adjacent to the Slough Trading Estate. One of our facilities is at Stockley. And, you know, we've enjoyed, you know, good activity with, particularly with the hyperscalers, because we didn't enter to the London market. You know, we committed to our first facility in 15, but it wasn't sort of delivered until 16. So we caught London really a couple of years into the hyperscale market. And you know, that meant that we got a brand new portfolio that suited the hyperscalers. And as each year has passed, the scale of the facilities that we've been deploying has increased. You know, in the early days, it was 9-10 megawatts of IT load. Our latest facilities, London 4 and 5, are each 18 megawatts. There's a very good chance that we will have limited capacity in our existing London portfolio towards the end of this year. And that's what prompted us to early in last year buy 33 acres of land to serve the Slough and Hayes availability zones. And we're just working up that site, but we hope that could deliver up to 70 to 80 megawatts of IT load across a number of facilities.
How are you finding it from a power access perspective, though? Because a lot of people I'm talking to now are saying that, you know, one of the main challenges within London and the surrounds is the access to power and the availability of that power. Is that something that you're having to kind of react to?
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, Cyrus had a pretty good vision around the time they were looking to buy us. The latest London facilities were envisaged a few years ago, so we were able to lock out the power. So, you know, London 4 and 5, we've got 27 megawatts energized, and we moved to about 54 megawatts within 6 months. And we were quite lucky, because people will tell you in West London, if you're applying for power now, you're probably going to be told it's not until 2027 that you will get power. And indeed, the reason why we bought the site that we bought was because it was virtually adjacent to one of the major substations, and therefore there's just a number of different technical solutions to deliver power. And because it's a major problem. There'll be solutions. I don't think there's any doubt about it. you know, we were talking to the government yesterday and they were questioning us over, you know, what are the major issues that we see for London in terms of London being able to support significant growth in data centres, and power is obviously one, and a desire really to see a more streamlined town and country planning process, probably two, mainly because the hyperscalers are looking at significant size sites. West London's become quite constrained, you know, as the market moves more north, northeast, you know, inevitably you're tracking through the Greenbelt. And so there needs to be some serious thinking from the government around how they are going to approach consents for data centres looking to expand, particularly in or close to the Greenbelt.
Yeah, and that's really interesting. Obviously, those conversations are taking place at that level now, because it's, I was going to ask you about it later, but we can kind of touch on it now. But the exposure of the industry, you know, from data centres perspective to, I suppose it must be quite surprising for people like you to be having conversations with the government around how we can increase the capacity of data centres and how can we develop more data centres in the UK. Is that new, or were you having those conversations pre-pandemic?
I think the interesting thing for me personally was just the experience that we had with the German government when Cyrus bought Xenium, which was obviously pre-pandemic.
Yeah.
We exchanged contracts in the December of 17, and then it took 9 months for the German government to approve the deal. And that gave me exposure to this issue of critical national infrastructure, because just before we exchanged contracts, the German government had effectively pulled data centers into the definition of critical national infrastructure, anything over 5 megawatts. And we were just very, very, very unlucky in the sense that it was new legislation. The government departments were just trying to understand what data centers were, and, you know, each participant in the industry, what their real role was and what their real risk to national security was. So I felt I kind of got under the skin of government thinking. So it was when the pandemic arrived, it happened to coincide with a lot of European governments having already been studying the data center industry and trying to figure out where they felt the industry should be positioned in terms of its criticality. Is it just essential services? Is it critical services? And what regulation and support do they need to give to the industry? And so what was great is those discussions had been going on through partner organisations like Tech UK with the government for some time, to be fair. And therefore, they were able to make the government quick decisions because the discussions had been had. And so you probably saw how quickly we moved to an essential status, which was just a lifesaver for us and others when the pandemic really got a grip, because it meant that we had the ability to move goods and move people around under the banner of essential service. And without that, we'd have been in terrible trouble. You know, the industry would have struggled to grow.
Yeah, I guess what it did is it kind of expedited those decisions, didn't it? It made the government have to make those decisions then and now, as like you say, but the conversations were already taking place. It was more the decision just had to be taken at that point, which is sometimes what we all need to make the decision.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it helped that the same thing was going on in the
audience. Everywhere. Yeah.
And there was a degree of uniformity that came out as a result. You know, and interestingly, the only construction shutdown we had was in Ireland, where they basically stopped all construction in the first lockdown for 8 weeks. And then in this second lockdown, or third or fourth, depending on how you define it, you know, data centers were viewed as essential and construction was allowed to continue.
Yeah, and that brings us on nicely to kind of your other locations. So obviously you're located in, you know, we talked about London, but also Frankfurt, Amsterdam, and Dublin. Are these, you mentioned
Paris.
Your... And Paris.
Finally announced Paris on our last earnings call.
Well, there you go. Some news from Paris. Are these areas, you mentioned you're developing in Dublin, but are these areas you also, you obviously you're there, but you're also expanding within?
Yes. So Dublin was a Cyrus One vision, and we've stood up an 18 megawatt shell, and we're building out 9 megawatts of IT, which we hope to sign a lease on quite soon. We then have the ability to do two further 18 megawatt buildings, which would be nice. I mean, it's a different market, Dublin, because it's generally a hyperscale self-build market. So, you know, the demand is really quite contingent on whether the hyperscale community have a need from you at any given time.
And also, we're seeing a lot of development outside of the main, you know, flat, whatever they call it these days, regions. Exactly. I want someone to come up with a new acronym on this.
Flat so, D.
So please, anyone listening, if you have any ideas, the industry needs your help. But we're obviously seeing a lot of development outside of these regions now, you know, whether you call them tier two, tier three, whatever you want to call them regions. But is that, again, are you looking at these regions at the moment? Is that a potential access to new areas?
Absolutely. I mean, I'll just, sorry to bore you with data, but you know, the European colo market in flat D is, you know, 1,900 or thereabouts megawatts. There's only about 800 megawatts in all the other bits of Europe combined, taking that to 2,700 megawatts. The US market is 5,600 megawatts, so more than double. And when you compare the GDP of Europe and the US, Europe's 18.9 trillion and the US is 18.3. The point that I'm making is there is a hell of a long way to go in terms of Europe catching up with the rest of the world, and whether that's been due to sort of cultural barriers in terms of outsourcing that are now sort of transcended by the digital economy, allowing, you know, outsourcing to the cloud to just break through those barriers and keep going, or what, I'm not sure. But most industry experts take the view that the global colo market will expand at 11.5% a year for the next 5 years. Europe will be expanding at 12.5%, i.e. oversized, and North America only at 6.7%. So the point being that there's a long way to go. Now, when you think about the scale of even the scale difference of even some of the flat D markets, you know, you've got London at 750 megawatts or thereabouts, and Frankfurt's not yet at 500, and much smaller scale in Paris, for example. There's good growth opportunities in those smaller flat D markets, I would say, you know, particularly Paris, for the reasons I mentioned. But then outside of flat D, you know, it's binary, really. As soon as the countries become regions for the hyperscalers, you see exponential growth. So Madrid, for example, which was languishing at about a 35, 40 megawatt market for a long time post the telco boom, you know, suddenly become a region. You've suddenly seen significant deployment from the hyperscalers. And to be honest, if you think logically, you know, the hyperscalers will want, as their businesses really stabilize and they get a far better view of demand from their products over the next 5 years, they'll look to be the masters of their own destiny and acquire land and develop just as they did in North America. Yet in the smaller markets, you know, where they're just deploying regions, they just don't know how those markets are going to go. So they're going to rely on, you know, other people's capital as their growth requirements develop. So as a colo provider, you know, you should be in those, I wouldn't call them emerging markets, in those new regent markets, because that's where you're going to see the hyperscalers wanting to rely on you and giving you growth.
Yeah, I think it's another, you know, new regions, emerging markets, tier two, tier three. It's another element that nobody really knows what to call it. But yeah, I totally agree. It's kind of more new regions rather than, you know, an emerging areas. It's places where there is activity. And like you say, the hyperscalers are moving. I always say on these, you know, every week you see a new cloud region announced by Microsoft. Yeah, it's literally every week at the moment. So all these areas are going to become developed pretty quickly.
Yeah, totally.
Also wanted to touch on sustainability. I know I watched a video from yourselves this morning, actually, on your heat reuse in Amsterdam. It's quite a clever technology, and I know it's being utilized across the industry now. But are you implementing other things all the time? And how do you think the industry can, you know, sort of manage the sustainability side?
It's a really good point. And it goes hand in glove with what we were talking about earlier in terms of garnering government support. What's going to come with increased visibility on the market by the governments is going to be increased regulation, because, you know, perception or reality, data centers are not considered to be the cleanest. We've announced that we're going to be carbon neutral as a global business by 2040. In Europe, we've been pushing on, you know, things like we were 100% renewable from an energy point of view in London last year, and we will be across the whole of Europe by the end of this year. We obviously work with all the data center associations, particularly the EU DCA, and, you know, we've helped them to move towards this climate neutral pact, which is, you know, 25 organizations coming together and basically looking at self-regulation within the data center industry to become effectively, you know, far closer to carbon neutral by 2030. And it's, you know, it's all the things that you would imagine. It's conserving water and energy through effective design. It's the old adage of heat less to cool, right cooling, right place, right time, all these things. But essentially what we're looking to do is upgrade older facilities with more efficient technologies and deploy much more efficient technologies in our new buildings just to continue to reduce the carbon footprint. In addition to that, we're then obviously working with our customers, because our customers see this as just a massive issue for them. So we're doing pilot projects with a lot of our customers, including, you know, zero waste projects, for example, in Germany. So we're doing an awful lot.
Yeah, I was going to say that about the customers. You know, when a customer's coming to you now, then is it kind of one of their main priorities is the sustainability of the facility and the design and how it all works to manage that problem?
Yeah, and it's somewhat, I wouldn't say it's self-solving, but ultimately the customers want a very efficient facility, because, you know, they're paying for effectively the power that is driving their servers, but they're also paying for the through whatever means, whether it's directly in the rent or however it is, they're paying for the overall running of the facility as well. And so they want it to be as efficient as possible because they want to keep their costs down. Naturally there's a drive, but also they've got enormous corporate targets to meet, and those targets wash all the way down through the organization. So they want to partner with us to make sure that we're helping them meet those targets. I think one of the challenges has been that, particularly around PUE, you know, lowering PUEs, you know, using, you know, indirect adiabatic coolers, for example, then has a knock-on issue with water. So, you know, you've got to be really clinical on what goals you're really focused on and want to deliver against, so that you actually score well across the gambit rather than in just one particular area.
Yeah. And other thing I'll quickly touch on before we kind of close up is, during the pandemic, I know we spoke about it briefly, but I saw one of Soros One's values is agility. And I think, you know, being agile was something that the industry was brilliant at during the pandemic. So I thought it tied in quite well. But what was it like being on the inside, you know, from your perspective, as the market and the demand just exponentially grew? how was it as a, you know, managing director of quite a large business unit, sort of dealing with those challenges?
Exhausting.
It's still exhausting now. I'm still catching up now.
Last year was a blur, to be honest. And you know, I'll constantly say it, that you know, I can't thank my colleagues enough, whether it's operations folk or construction folk or whatever, for being so committed and putting themselves in harm's way the entire time. You know, you can't not have a manned data center. You can't not have a manned construction site. And so incredible, really. And I think that was, you know, driven as partly from the Cyrus culture, you know, that everybody was happy to be part of Cyrus One, felt privileged to be in an industry that was growing as opposed to declining through the pandemic, and therefore, you know, wanted to do their absolute best. So it was pacey. I think the issue was you never quite knew what was coming at you at any one time, whether it be, as we talked about, the closure of site, both closure of construction in Dublin, whether you suddenly found that you got a case of COVID on site and you had to rapidly, you know, isolate people who've been in contact, and then deal with program issues because of falling man levels on site. There were all sorts of issues, as you can imagine, about kit. You know, at the beginning of the pandemic, we were having transformers made in Northern Italy. Well, that didn't really work. So we had to be quite agile in terms of where we were procuring kit from to keep our programs on target. The biggest unforeseen challenge, to be honest, was the increased cycle time on permits, whether they be construction permits or occupancy permits, with, you know, some noticeable serious problems. So Frankfurt was one, where the city of Frankfurt just found it very difficult to cope with the volume of applications, and France, where the national state of health emergency led to a dispensation given to the government departments in terms of issuing permits. And I think the most important thing to point out is that through the years leading up to the beginning of last year, the customers have become more and more sophisticated, more and more understanding of the development process and their importance in it. And therefore, you know, develop standards, particularly around, you know, not accepting delivery of data halls unless there are occupancy permits in place, you know, having far greater focus on witnessing commissioning, et cetera. So, you know, the landscape had already changed, making it, you know, much, much more intense in terms of building and delivery. So when the pandemic hit, it was a, you know, it magnified the issue, to be honest.
Yeah, and I think everyone's just looking forward to kind of having a break at some point and looking back on 2020, whenever that may be, you know, whether it's having a beer in a bar and chatting about it. I think the whole industry just needs a break, a bit of a rest and a bit of a discussion around what actually happened.
Yeah, well, you know, what actually happened was in your favourite flat D market, there was nearly 300 megawatts of headline signings. I mean, that was a 50% growth on the year before. And that all happened in a pandemic. You know, there are obviously a lot of megawatts delivered and a lot of megawatts still to be delivered relative to that 300. But, you know, that was monumental, monumental year.
I agree with what you say. I think it was a blur. And I think you need to sometimes sort of sit back and look back and think what actually did happen. I think there's a lot of people that were just so busy, they haven't had that opportunity to actually sit back and analyse what happened and think, what did we do well? What can we do better? You know, what maybe shouldn't we have done? And again, it's just having that time to be able to do it, which the industry is struggling to do at the moment because the growth is continuing.
Yeah. But yeah, the thing is, as a public company, you have to stop and think and explain to the analysts and the shareholders, you know, exactly what is going on. You know, you don't have the luxury just being able to keep running and then think about reflection later, which is one of the challenges, you know, being a public company in environments like this. But equally, it's great because it just makes you think and makes you, you know, set out a path to learn from what's gone on and optimize your business as a result of that learning. And, you know, for us, it's all about how do we effectively manage the situation where a lot of the big customers have now sort of set in stone their designs and want us to follow those designs. How do we ensure that we can still be agile in terms of standardizing our specifications for those customers and, you know, enhancing the supply chain to make sure that we can still get a kit in and installed as quickly as we used to. It's things like that. So you've got to keep going because this market isn't going to take a pause. That's for sure.
No, exactly. And we're very fortunate to be in it as well, which I think is easy to forget. Yeah. And I also think what it's done from my perspective, and, you know, one of the reasons why I started the podcast was to increase exposure. I think the exposure of the industry has been magnified significantly now. People know what it is. People know about it. And that's only going to help the industry as a whole attract more people, develop, progress people. So there's a lot of positives that will come out of it from our perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Before we finish up, there's just one question I ask everybody on my podcast just to get your ideas and your views for my listeners. But if there was one piece of advice you could give to anyone looking to work in the industry, what would it be?
If you love your smartphone, you should be working in the industry. I think, yeah, the point is that digital economy is the future. It's a really exciting place to be. And with data centers, just, you know, don't be put off by any notion of complexity. I mean, there's a lot of jargon. There's, you know, issues to do with how capital intensive things are. They're not complicated. The industry is not complicated. It's a joy to work in it, and people should, you know, peer over the fence because it's a good place to be and easy to work in if you know what you're doing.
Yeah, definitely. Someone said to me the other day, if you look past the buzzwords, it's a fairly simple industry.
That's absolutely right. Absolutely right.
Thanks very much for your time today. I really enjoyed that conversation. Hopefully, you know, we shared a bit of value regarding your career, how you got to where you are, and also about CyrusOne and your plans for the future across Europe.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And thanks for giving me the opportunity to put something out there for your listeners, Andy. Really appreciate it.
No problem at all. Take care. Enjoy the rest of lockdown in the UK.
Yes. My daughter's 21st birthday party. Well, not party. Sorry, I didn't say that. It's her 21st birthday this weekend, and her party is having dinner with her parents. So you can imagine how chuffed she is with lockdown.
Well, wish her a happy birthday, and we can edit out the bit about the birthday party. Thank you very much for your time, man. It's great. It's been great to speak to you.
Cheers. Thanks, Andy.
Take care. Cheers.